This show is brought to you by MTN. For your everyday moves, try this new MTN app. MTN, SA's best network.
I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is the Tech Central Show. The show is brought to you by MTN Business. Visit www.mtnbusiness.co.za to learn more. And we thank them for partnering with Tech Central to bring you these great interviews. Now, returning to the Tech Central Show today is Dominic Cull. Dominic is a long-suffering lawyer in the ICT sector. His company is called Ellipsis, and he also serves as regulatory advisor and has for many years to the Internet Service Providers Association, which keeps him busy and very much out of trouble, I believe. Dominic, it's good to see you again. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you, Duncan. Trying to actually stay in trouble is my job description, not out of trouble, which makes life interesting.
For sure. You recently attended Minister Solly Malatsi's colloquium in Pretoria. I think it was on policy development in the sector. What was your headline takeaway from that event? We obviously also have a minister here from a party that isn't the ANC for the first time in 30 plus years. Is there a discernible difference in approach?
I think there is. I think the minister in the first place faces obstacles that his predecessors didn't face, in that there is a certain amount of pushback from within the department. I think there was some reorganization of the department before the minister took up his position, which created quite a lot of uncertainty about who was responsible for what. So kind of classic political plays that went down. And you can also see, I guess, particularly through that policy directive around equity equivalent investment programs, that there's a lot of antipathy from the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee, which is very much on party lines. So previous ministers would get a far more gentle, welcoming and general treatment from that portfolio committee. As a DA minister, Minister Malatsi gets the opposite. So I think he's doing well. I think the takeaway from the policy colloquium is that it was really to placate certain sectors of industry and society that have taken up this notion that we need a policy overhaul, that there's policy uncertainty, that legislation is outdated. And you hear these statements all the time without any content or examples. So I think this is the minister saying, I'm a new minister. There are certain things happening, but I hear lots of people calling for certainty around broadcasting, certainty around artificial intelligence, over the tops, et cetera, et cetera. So let's kick off a process to start looking at those. But let's also be aware that there are other processes which are already unfolding. And let's be clear about where this policy uncertainty is. So, Duncan, I think it's worth just unpacking that for a moment. So policy uncertainty means different things to different people. If you're in the broadcasting or the video on demand content provision space, then you're really talking about the fact that it's taken us almost 6 years in developing a new audiovisual and audiovisual media services policy document. So there's been recent progress under the new minister. They're looking to finalize that by the end of March next year. But essentially, you know, that's the broadcasters saying we've got the Netflix and the Amazons and the Apples coming in and competing with us. We need regulatory parity. We need a level playing field. These people need to be brought into the licensing framework. If you are interested in artificial intelligence, then your policy uncertainty is in the fact that we're 3 years down the line in terms of finalizing national AI policy. And again, we expect that to be done by the end of March next year. If you're in the telecom space, particularly in MNO, then your policy uncertainty, as you articulate it, is really driven by the entry of the over-the-top players like Meta, Instagram, TikTok, as well as the entry of the low Earth orbit satellite players in the future. So you're concerned about how things are going to look. If, however, we cast our eyes back over the last 4 years, you will see that in that period, we have finalized policy on rapid deployment of electronic communications networks and facilities. We have finalized policy on radio frequency spectrum. We have finalized policy on data and cloud. So I'm a little bit bemused about the claims of policy uncertainty. There's policy under development. There's policy that is still to be implemented, but that doesn't equate to uncertainty. If you don't like the policy, that also doesn't equate to uncertainty. And I think the minister is aware of this. So the policy colloquium was really a way of letting everyone speak, get their items onto the agenda without any firm follow-up steps. We're not sure what's going to actually happen next. But we already have these policy initiatives around broadcasting, audiovisual media services, AI, in play. So I'm unconvinced that there's policy uncertainty. I'm unconvinced that there's a need for complete legislative overhaul of the Electronic Communications Act. It's actually fit for purpose. What we don't have is a regulator which is capable of actually implementing what that act says. So there are definitely bits which could be improved, but mainly what people are referring to is that we need to develop new legislation for broadcasting and we need to develop national AI legislation. So in the policy colloquium, there was no speaking from the positions of the MNOs or the broadcasters. Everyone was split up. They all brought different agenda items. The wrap-up was really, we'll go away and think about the things that you've raised and advise you on next steps, which is, I'm not sure that's really what stakeholders were looking for. But, you know, having said that, there are some definite things coming in terms of policy and legislative amendment, which I think the minister is aware of, but perhaps people in the room were not aware of. So, for example, in April, the Department of Communications has indicated the Electronic Communications Amendment Bill will be in Parliament. That is the one which was circulated in 2023 for comment. It is based on the outcomes of the Competition Commission's Data Services Market Inquiry. And for those who can cast their mind back to 2023, the big items there were possibly introducing new licensing categories for the tower cos and the data centers, a focus on a framework for mobile virtual network operators, which is a key growth area in South Africa for providing choice in mobile data and driving down costs. And then also some simplification of the processes which ICASA needs to take to look at competition. I think we all recognize that the regulator has been unable to meet the procedural requirements of the act in terms of imposing pro-competitive conditions. So again, that bill was looking to simplify those. So it will, the dominant item for next year will not be policy review. It will be this Electronic Communications Amendment Bill. There will be a lot of debate, I think specifically around the MVNO framework, because that is threatening to the mobile networks. And you've seen statements recently from Vodacom and MTN cautioning about too many MVNOs, disincentivizes infrastructure investment, et cetera, et cetera. So that is a critical argument for next year, as well as potentially bringing tower cos and data centers into the licensing framework. So the policy colloquium to me was a checklist kind of event. It was to say, we've done this. We've got everyone together. We have a broad range of issues we can pick and choose from if necessary. But actually the real action is going to be amending legislation introduced into Parliament, like I say, in April next year.
You mentioned MTN and Vodacom and the MVNOs. Do you think they have a point?
They do. You know, it's an argument which has happened around the world. I think the MNOs would be quick to point to some European jurisdictions where there does seem to have – the Netherlands is one they like. But there have been other jurisdictions where MVNOs have made a real difference. And my own belief is that they have already made a substantial difference in the cost to communicate in South Africa. So you are, as an MVNO, restricted to certain kinds of business models. ICASA's regulations around numbering currently inexplicably restrict MVNOs from embracing fuller models of working with the host MNO networks. So that's also something to be sorted out. But even on this limited basis of acting as branded resellers, we see a lot more choice, we see a lot more value add, and quite frankly, we see data prices below those offered by MTN, Vodacom, and others. So it's good for the South African consumer currently. Next year, we'll really bring into focus those arguments you're referring to, balancing, incentivizing infrastructure investment against consumer benefit. And I think also, as the mobile networks start to utilize more and more of the spectrum which they were awarded after March 2022, they will start to utilize more for their own purposes and want to dedicate less to wholesale MVNO type deals. So I think certainly for MTN, they said, we've got all the spectrum, we need to commercialize, we need to monetize. MVNOs make a lot of sense to do that. Vodacom has taken a far more cautious approach to potentially cannibalizing its own revenue in future. So a fascinating argument for next year, and it will be vibrant.
So just coming out of the colloquium, if you were to choose one thing where you would think, well, hey, we're doing really well in this area, that we're right to be focusing on this particular area of policy or regulation, and then if you could maybe name one thing that came out of the colloquium or didn't come out of the colloquium that you think needs a lot more attention?
So two things I would point to. One is, from a policy perspective, I do feel there is a need to take a step back and recognize that all of the targets we have set out in policies like the National Broadband Policy, SA Connect, the ICT White Paper, the National Infrastructure Plan, those targets have been missed. And that currently we don't have a clear plan to actually meet them. So the 2013 SA Connect National Broadband Plan will talk about 100% connectivity of schools at 100 megabits per second by 2030. We're not in a position to make that. We've missed all the antecedent targets. So the most important thing I would like to see come out of that process is to say, let's reconceptualize the targets. Firstly, let's recognize that having targets tied solely to connectivity, that's an inadequate approach. There is a growing adoption around the world of something called Universal Meaningful Connectivity, UMC. It's a very simple, intuitive notion that it's not enough for the South African government to say, that person falls within some kind of connectivity. They can receive 4G or 5G or fixed wireless or fiber. We need to look at it as they must have access to the service when they require it. They must be able to afford to use the service meaningfully. They must be able to afford the device to access the service. And they must have the digital skills and the literacy to use it safely and securely. So there are five elements that go into this universal meaningful connectivity model. It's very much something that's in vogue with the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union. It's a G20 development. So Brazil, who were president before us, did a lot of work. We've carried on with that work around UMC. And it allows for very easy comparisons. So you can go onto the ITU's data hub right now and you can see where South Africa sits in respect of those five metrics against the rest of the world and against the ITU's particular standards. So let's reevaluate the targets. Let's also recognize that the access gap is probably not as bad as we think about, as we think it is. So there'll be research coming out of the National Planning Commission in the next couple of weeks, which indicates that it's around 400 to 500,000 households that do not currently have access to some kind of broadband connectivity. So that's roughly 1.2% of households in South Africa. That's a tremendously good news story. It's a private sector good news story, to be sure. But in fact, the issue is not so much establishing connectivity. The issue is very much affordability in terms of the devices and affordability in terms of the services. In terms of the devices, you see a lot of action at the moment, MTN, Vodacom offering discounted access to handsets. The GSMA is doing a lot of work. There's a handset affordability coalition. So that is really about the mobile networks saying, well, we are transitioning out of 2G and 3G services. We want to reform that spectrum for something more useful. We have to take our subscribers with us on that journey. Otherwise, they're going to be people who cannot access our services and we cannot earn revenue from them. So they are motivated in terms of the affordability of the device. That's reasonably, I think, easy to solve. Affordability of services is a far trickier issue and a sticky issue, particularly in South Africa. And there, you know, the GSMA focuses on affordability of devices, but not of services. So there, things like MVNOs, these end user subscriber service charter regulations, which ICASA does, which deal with data rollover, those are massively contentious at the moment. Again, there's a lot of political, not interference, but lobbying of ICASA to extend those data rollover periods up to 6 months or 3 years, which is being opposed by the MNOs. Interestingly, the South African average monthly expenditure on data is below 2% gross monthly income per individual, which is 2% is the ITU's kind of yardstick, which indicates we're doing well there, but ignores the massive income disparity in South Africa. So there are still a large number of households that are not able to afford the services which they are actually able to access. And that needs to be the focus of policy moving forward. So that would be the one thing I'd like to focus on. The second thing is broadband mapping. Mapping. So for the first time, probably early next year, we will see a national broadband map, which has been developed through the National Planning Commission and the Development Bank of South Africa. That's a map which essentially plots how close households, schools, and other public service institutions are to fiber access points, within 5 kilometers, 10, 15, 20, 25. And it shows where the interventions are actually required, where infrastructure needs to be deployed, where money needs to be spent, And it's, I mean, Duncan, it's a statement of the obvious to say that it's a critical piece of evidence that you need before you plan on how you're going to spend money, both as the private sector and the state. So as the, what I would really like the minister to focus on is having that broadband mapping exercise, making sure that there's open information standards, so that is publicly available information subject to competition law restrictions. At the same time, we need a database of spectrum use, which ICASA should have in order to track what the mobile networks are doing and where spectrum is being used, again, as a basis for future planning and deployment. So I'd love us to recognize that we need new targets and we need new plans to reach those targets. And I'd love us to recognize that the first things we should do to in those new plans is to assess what we have and where the gaps are on a evidence-based approach, not this kind of thumbsuck or there's been a storm here and suddenly we worry about that.
It sounds quite exciting, this mapping project. One hopes it's going to be open source and that NGOs and everyone else in the public is going to be able to manipulate that data and use it for planning and all of the rest of it.
Absolutely. I mean, just overlaying that data with Stats SA affordability data gives you an extremely interesting picture. And Duncan, I don't want to overstate it. So it's a first attempt at a broadband map. It needs to be refined. For example, over the last 6 to 12 months, we've seen a lot of action in the townships, in the lower LSM areas with fiber deployment. And with the massive deal, we're likely to see a lot more of that. So it's a, that broadband map needs to be constantly updated. And there is a mechanism currently, you know, where licensees are obliged to report to ICASA where their network is, but there appears to be a lack of skills within ICASA to actually take that and put it into a GIS database.
Be interesting to apply some AI to that data set as well, because presumably you could, if you put an AI overlay over it, you could then query it and say, well, where could we deploy this infrastructure? Where is it most needed and how much would it cost to build it there?
Absolutely. I mean, I won't go into it, but that report you'll see does include a figure for what is required to close that broadband gap. And let's roughly say that figure is between 100 and 140 billion rand. But the interesting thing there is that that is not money required from government. So this is not a government expenditure thing. That is government getting out of the way or facilitating investment from the private sector, which will close that gap. The LEOs will play a role. The spectrum obligations will play a role, but it doesn't require any expenditure from government, which is a message government needs to hear.
I mean, just coming back to government spending, the SA Connect project, you mentioned it's fallen behind on many of its targets. What is the reason for that? Is it state dysfunction or are there other issues?
It's difficult to pin down exactly the problems. One of them, I'll be blunt about, is Broadband Infraco, which is, you know, we know the history of it. We know that it's very much reliant on other state-owned companies, Eskom and the like, for its underlying infrastructure. It essentially adds a markup to that infrastructure and then on-sells it to government or private sector. The Auditor General was in Parliament a few weeks ago reaffirming that BBI remains technically insolvent and, in their view, is not going to be able to trade its way out of that. And BBI is at the center of SA Connect. So it's difficult to be clear about where money is going, how it's being spent, is money which should be being used for deployment actually keeping Broadband Infraco afloat at the moment? So One of the things that needs to be done is the institutional framework and the delivery framework needs to be revised. The Broadband Access Fund, which is this fund available for SMME ISPs to do their own infrastructure deployments and then be compensated for it, I think that's an idea worth holding on to. There is recognition that there need to be funding mechanisms upfront for CapEx to help the SMMEs, and there's work being done on that. But there needs to be a lot more transparency in terms of what's actually going on in that fund. There were promises about including industry in the bid adjudication committee, which hasn't happened. So we'd like a little more light to be shone there. And then, Duncan, there's a truly bizarre strain of thought. So I've said to you, you know, this is the addressable market for broadband. This is what the private sector is doing. But there's this bizarre strand of thought that on the part of some in government that Broadband InfraCo and SA Connect is going to connect everyone. Mm-hmm. So they say, you know, we've connected 1.88 million households already, and if we get the funding, we'll connect the rest. And it just seems quite mad, given what is happening with the private sector in a lot of those areas. Their figures in terms of 1.88 million households, I think, need to be carefully interrogated. I'm not sure what they're using in terms of coverage per Wi-Fi access point, for example, but that figure seems to be very high for me. And Duncan, it's always the case that probably the biggest barrier to any kind of reform here is jobs and people. So BBI knows it's under threat, and it's doing everything it can to convince Parliament and others of its continued relevance and that it has a role to play, which I think it self-evidently actually does not. Just to mention there as well, because it's interesting, the BBI is meant to be merged with Centec at some stage to form this prototype state digital infrastructure company. And that's fantastic policy. As an idea for government to say, we have all these infrastructure assets, not just fiber and ducts, but Department of Public Works and Infrastructure has towers, the provinces have things, local government has things. If we could pull this all together, you could actually make quite a powerful, compelling infrastructure offer into the market. But in fact, the opposite's happening. So, because of BBI's insolvency, the merger with Centec is not going ahead. DCDT still thinks it should be trying, which again, I don't know. I don't think that can be supported. The extensive assets held by Eskom, Praza, Portnet, Sanral are criminally underutilized. So a lot of that extensive fiber infrastructure, particularly in the middle mile, so not access, but metro reticulation, middle mile stuff, that is, in their own words, rotting in the ground. And they're all trying to do deals with the private sector separately to get investment into their networks to try and make them viable. So you've seen deals announced with Vodacom, et cetera. That's going to probably continue to happen. But what actually needs to take place is again, a mapping exercise to say, well, what does the state own in this space? Because in reality, the state has an opportunity in the next 5 years to maintain some kind of relevance in the connectivity space. If it doesn't pull those assets together, if it doesn't start sharing costs in terms of remote support, if it doesn't take baby steps towards consolidation, it runs a very real risk of being completely irrelevant to connectivity in South Africa. That might not actually be a bad thing for government expenditure, because another reality at the moment is that the private sector is the primary service provider for government. And what you see is CETA and others acquiring links from Telkom or Liquid or private sector providers, and then adding a substantial markup to that before selling it on to government, which, if you think about it, makes very little sense whatsoever. We've kind of got stuck in this merry-go-round of money moving from one state-owned company to another. You see it with Centec and the SABC. So we need some kind of rationalization and reduction in that space if the government is going to remain relevant. If you talk to the Competition Commission and say, you know, how do we facilitate investment into digital connectivity infrastructure? They look at you and say, there are two areas right now in South Africa where you don't need to facilitate investment because it is ready and willing to come in, and that is digital connectivity infrastructure and alternative energy infrastructure. So the private sector is moving. Government needs to act with historically unexpected or unwarranted urgency, if it wants to actually utilize the assets it has and remain a player in connectivity in the country.
There's an argument to be made that the government has actually gotten in the way most of the time in terms of reform and achieving goals in this industry, and it's actually the private sector that's always stepped in. I mean, the undersea cables is probably a classic example of that. It was tightly controlled by the government through Telkom, and it was private sector investment that opened up that space. Should we be bemoaning the possibility that government might not have a role at all to play in the sector going forward?
No, I think it's their choice, and that, you know, you mentioned the undersea cable stuff, which is of course a great example, because that's CECOM saying, hey, we want to come and land a cable here. Government gets lobbied by Telkom, and so that would break the SAT3 monopoly. And if you recall correctly, the minister at the time then issued draft guidelines on rapid deployment for undersea cables, essentially saying we'd own 50% of the cable here in South Africa.
Yes, I remember.
So, you know, fortunately that went nowhere, and it was withdrawn 2 years later. And we can absolutely see the result. We've gone from a SAT3 monopoly in 2009 to an abundance of choice and redundancy now. So, you know, government should not be in the way. I think industry would go further and say government actually needs to play a role in facilitating certain things. So municipalities come up a lot in the policy colloquium. Okay. As being a barrier to rapid deployment, et cetera, et cetera. You know, people in the room in that policy colloquium, all the telecoms people, think that the DCDT should do something about it. But it's not a DCDT responsibility, and there's no one in that room who can do something about municipalities. There is a broader recognition from national government and the president that the state of municipalities needs to be addressed urgently. So there are initiatives to sort that out. But you're never going to get rapid deployment right in a dysfunctional, insolvent municipality. It's not going to happen. So, yeah. You know, broader government can definitely play a role in terms of helping municipalities with capacity, with training, skills, et cetera, et cetera. And to their credit, they have done some of that, but there is a long road to go. The regulator would be another one we need to look at in terms of, is government facilitating or is it in the way? And certainly I would believe that some kind of institutional review is necessary at ICASA. They are doing their own institutional review at the moment towards what they call the regulator of the future. But I think it's quite clear that they haven't achieved their mandate in terms of things they're required to do. And what worries me about ICASA is that if I look at the next 3 or 4 years, and the marquee items which they will have on their agenda, I worry that there's a risk of implosion. So, you know, in the next 3 years, they're going to have to deal with this, another spectrum auction, which is already delayed. they're going to have to renew all the service licenses, the IECS, IECNS licenses. They're going to have to renew the IMT 900, 1800, 2100 spectrum licenses, which the mobiles hold. They're going to have to deal with the transformation issue around LEO satellites and Starlink. And just those four issues are going to be so high profile with so much risk of delay and litigation, that I really am concerned that things might get to a stage where the regulator is effectively unable to perform its mandate. From their perspective, they're doing a great job of trying to get more funding. Mm-hmm. They're trying to look at the funding models for ICASA. I think that's correct. I think they need to persuade government that they have a great value in terms of the digital transformation journey ahead of the country. That 14.3 billion rand in revenue from a spectrum auction is the kind of thing that you can start to realize when you have an effectively functioning regulator. So in other words, it's a conversation about the value of ICASA in the society we're trying to build, and good for ICASA that they are trying to sort that out. However, there is no question that they should be doing better with what they have. And recently they suffered an embarrassing turnaround in court with their mobile broadband services regulations. It's a narrative we've heard before. You know, they try and intervene in a market, but they cannot get the procedural steps right. So when MTN comes along and wants those regulations declared invalid, it's fairly predictable as to what's going to happen. So we need to sort out ICASA, also sort out what ICASA is responsible for. They want to be a regulator for AI. They want to be a regulator for all sorts of things. I worry that you need to be able to do your core competence before you start expanding into other things.
Is a solution perhaps for ICASA to keep some of the proceeds of the spectrum auction?
No. They need to come up with a budget that says we'll currently receive, say, 450 million rand a year. But in order to get equipment that we need to monitor mobile networks and spectrum usage and quality of service, we're going to need an additional amount. So I think the onus is on them to motivate for a higher allocation from Treasury. We're not in a fiscal situation where the Treasury is going to say, okay, well, you can keep 10% of what you earn without having a really good idea of what that actually is. So it's not about the methodology about where the money comes from. It's about the amount which government feels is correct to fund mm-hmm. a regulator in the space. So there is action happening there, but certainly structurally within ICASA, the way that council committees are formed, the way that things are done, it's way too slow. It's not mm-hmm. fit for purpose in this industry. I think they're aware of that. There are moves to finalize performance agreements and have back-to-back performance agreements coming down from the minister through the department to councillors, to different divisions of ICASA. That may help. There's a lot of noise about ICASA's independence. And again, we will probably revisit that old chestnut during 2026. I think, for example, with Starlink, ICASA might be preparing to assert its independence. Other words, to say to the minister that you're trying to achieve something through a policy direction, which we have legal advice to the effect that you should be amending the act.
Okay.
So that if you recall again, we had this with the previous spectrum auction and finalizing spectrum policy where ICASA wanted to go ahead with the auction and they got into a court fight with the minister, which they lost. So Duncan, let's sidestep onto Starlink there, because I've
yeah, let's talk about Starlink, because Ryan Goodnight, who seems to be on stages around the country a lot lately, a representative in South Africa from SpaceX, was claiming that Starlink could enter South Africa tomorrow if four lines were removed from the regulations. His suggestion was that it was as simple as taking a pen and scratching out these lines out of the ICASA regulations. It does seem to be taking Solly Malatsi a very long time to finalize this policy directive. A draft version was published, I think, back in February or March. Is it normal, first of all, for a policy directive to go into the sort of draft status and be discussed so widely before it's finalized? And what do you think the outcome of all of this is going to be?
So in terms of the policy direction, it's interesting. There were two policy directions published round about the same time in March, one relating to equity equivalent investment programs and LEOs, and the other one about ICASA starting to issue individual licenses on application, which it currently doesn't do. The second one is reasonably straightforward, and that was finalized, I think, in about 2 months. Which is a record by some distance for finalizing a policy direction in the communications ministry. The EIP one, it's been around 8 months. No, I don't think that's, based on historical evidence, I don't think that's excessive. The minister has, I think, indicated that there were 19,000 submissions. I see that there were 31,000 submissions from the Dear South Africa petition website itself. So, you know, accepting that a lot of those are saying things like BEE is bad or BEE is good, because this is a proxy battle for transformation. There are some of substance which need to be gone through. So the impression I've got is that the minister's team are finished with their part of the job, and there are other internal processes which now need to take place and consultations before that final policy direction is published. And again, when in doubt, look to the end of the government financial year. So the government financial year runs from 1st April to end March. And if you open up the Government Gazette in the last week of March, you will find countless notices trying to beat the deadline of the end of March. So typically these things tend to be finalized then, so that, you know, the department or the minister can go into Parliament and say it was done as I said it would be done in the 2025-2026 financial year. So no, I don't think it's excessive at this stage. And really, you know, with reference to Mr. Goodnight's statement, he is understandably frustrated. But the reality is that we haven't even begun with the process, which would eventually lead to Starlink being able to apply directly to ICASA for licensing. So let's say we get that finalized policy direction at the end of March. ICASA's then got to institute an inquiry into whether it should amend its regulations to align with the ICT sector code. That's typically a 6 to 12 month process right there. It's going to be complicated by the fact that local licensees, some of them, have already indicated that they're going to argue that if you're going to give this flexibility to a multinational company, you should also be giving it to local licensees. That's the principle of regulatory parity. I don't support it in this particular instance because I think the EEIP program is specifically set up within the transformation framework for multinationals. But that is going to be an argument that comes in. And then there will be a lot of arguments on a dry legalistic basis to say you have to amend the act. You can't do this through policy direction. At this stage, the portfolio committee is having meetings with the ICT Sector Council, with the DTIC. They are doing their homework to inform themselves about these EEIP agreements. How have they worked? Is this something which actually leads to real transformation? And that's them really rolling up their sleeves and saying, we've given notice that we're also going to get involved in this process once it hits ICASA, and we are quite strongly opposed to the notion. And I think a lot of that is tied up to personalities. So this is about Elon Musk and his profile and what he's had to say. That's hugely problematic for Starlink. If there's litigation, we literally could be in 2030 before they qualify to go and get the licenses. In the meantime, the existing LEOs, the Eutelsat OneWebs, are already doing business. Amazon Kuiper, from public reports, is very much gearing up to do business in South Africa. the Chinese constellations are busy putting things in the sky and also very much interested in South Africa. So if those are all partnering with local licensees, if, for example, Kuiper says, we're going to do a model where we, like Eutelsat OneWeb, we partner with the local licensee, they could essentially enter the market within 3 to 6 months. So subject to them actually having the hardware in the sky, their timeline to market is potentially years shorter than the one that Starlink has currently laid out. And that is going to be a problem. You know, if Mr. Goodnight is characterizing it as something that could be done tomorrow, then, you know, a couple of months down the line, a couple of years down the line, the frustration is going to explode. And that's going to be super interesting. I don't want to even begin to predict what the geopolitics looks like in a year's time, but it's probably not in our favor.
Yes, we've seen Mr. Musk posting certain things on X over the last year or so about his race and his ability to get a license in this country. So it's going to be fascinating to watch, especially Project Kuiper, which is a direct competitor to Starlink. And if Amazon comes in and says, okay, well, we'll have a BE partner in our local licensee, they could get into this market quickly. And what then, where does that leave Musk? Does he change his tune? Does he also do the same thing? Or does he take an ideological view on this and sit it out until 2029, 2030, whenever the law changes or the regulations change?
I can't see that somehow. You know, interestingly, they all seem to see South Africa as a key market that they want to get right. They want to put the earth stations and the ground infrastructure down in South Africa. One major question is, what is the addressable market for LEO satellites in South Africa? No one has a clear answer to that at the moment. There's a lot of nonsense being talked about addressing the universal service gap. And that's not the addressable market. Those are not generally people who can afford the services which are going to be offered. Yes, you know, rural base station enhancements and satellite backhaul will improve services in those areas, but it's not the LEOs per se providing the service. And I think one other interesting thing there, Duncan, is in one way I'd really like it if Starlink did get those individual licenses before the next spectrum auction. Because on the one hand, we're insisting that they play by local rules. But if they play by local rules, then it is also open to them to participate with their deep pockets in the next spectrum auction and say, actually, I would like some terrestrial spectrum in South Africa of my own in order to provide a direct-to-consumer service and disintermediate the existing providers. So that is certainly something the mobile networks will have in the back of their mind.
Yeah, interesting. I want to talk a bit about spectrum, because that is obviously a big one on ICASA's plate at the moment. What is the current status with the next spectrum auction, and when that does happen, what should be the priority focus areas in your view?
So there's nothing firm about the next spectrum auction. I think last year in Parliament, ICASA presented a timeline with various steps that need to be taken. And the first step is actually a potential banana skin, and also very interesting, because that is, they need to hold an inquiry into the competitive outcomes of the previous spectrum auction. So again, if you recall that last spectrum auction only went ahead after there was a settlement of High Court litigation with Telkom. And Telkom said, part of that settlement is, before you do this again, you will hold an inquiry into how this has actually worked out for competition. And ICASA has appointed service providers to do that exercise. And I'd imagine they are working behind the scenes to develop the documents that need to be part of that process. But that's hugely contentious, mainly because of spectrum sharing, spectrum pooling, which has taken place after that March 22 spectrum auction. So you know that MTN did deals with Liquid and Cell C, and they pooled spectrum, which is, you know, according to Vodacom, has given MTN an unfair advantage. And there is litigation again in the High Court, which should go to court sometime in the first or second quarter of next year. Where the court will be required to declare whether those agreements are valid or not. And that's going to have a massive impact, particularly for Liquid and Cell C, but also for how we view the next spectrum auction. In terms of that next auction, what I would like to see, what I'd like to see is unlikely to happen, because I think we're now very attached, as certainly as National Treasury, to the idea that this is a revenue generating exercise. But if we look more recently at Mozambique, for example, they're about to do an administrative assignment of 5G spectrum. So no spectrum auction, we will assign it to people who qualify, and you have an obligation to make sure that all provincial capitals have 5G coverage and the balance of the country has 4G coverage within a certain period of time. So trade-off, the spectrum auction cost against the obligations. Here in March 2022, we did both. There was a substantial amount paid for the spectrum, and also substantial obligations in terms of coverage, MVNOs, zero rating, things of that nature. When you, for example, see headlines about XMNO investing 280 million rand to upgrade its Limpopo network, trace that back to the spectrum licensing obligations. To improve your coverage in Limpopo using this spectrum. I don't think, you know, in March 2022, we had created such a bottleneck for spectrum for the MNOs that they were desperate for the process to go ahead. They were desperate to actually get some of the spectrum. That is not going to be the context for the next spectrum auction in 2028, 2029. So I think ICASA should reevaluate its position, hopefully using broadband maps, spectrum usage maps, to say this is where we need interventions. These are hard to serve areas where we want you to go in order to make sure that we close the digital divide by 2035. So I would far prefer an administrative exercise with obligations. I think the logic of MTN, Vodacom and others spending billions and not trying to reclaim that through data costs and services, I think we're unrealistic if we see it that way. So there's a negative impact for the consumer, which we should actually just avoid. But I would understand that National Treasury has got an appetite for spectrum auctions at the moment.
Yes. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the 6 gigahertz band. I'm hoping you've got a few more minutes for me, but The 6 gigahertz band in the EU, it's seen as one of the last big chunks of spectrum in the low and so-called low and mid bands. And it's been identified both for 5G and I think for 6G as well. Now, the EU is apparently poised to announce that they will be assigning most of the 6 gigahertz bands in Europe to mobile operators and not to Wi-Fi. I know the Wi-Fi lobby group has been arguing that much of the 6 gigahertz band should in fact be made available for Wi-Fi applications. What is your take on the move by the EU, and should ICASA be copying it?
Gosh, I'm a little surprised by the EU's position, mainly because it's contrary to what's being done in the US and a lot of Asia. So it made a lot of sense to me that we'd create this common application using this band across the world, which drives economies of scale and uptake. Duncan, I'm not party to all the considerations, but it is directly relevant in South Africa because we're region one in terms of how the ITU divides up the world along with the EU. Yes. So things they do are persuasive in terms of our position, and it's very much something we are looking at. So I'm a huge fan of ICASA's spectrum and engineering division in terms of they're active. They are doing some very interesting things in terms of dynamic spectrum access. They're looking at setting up these innovation spectrum bands, one of which is 3.8 to 4.2 gigahertz, and the other one is the lower 6 gigahertz, so 5.9 through to 6.4 odd, which is, you know, enabling databases and sharing of that spectrum on a serendipitous kind of check the database. If it's available, you can use it. So it may be that we follow Europe, but also look to extend that dynamic spectrum approach into the upper 6 gigahertz band so that, yes, it is primary allocation to mobile, but there is a firm secondary allocation on a non-interference basis for the Wi-Fi users, the WISPs, and the others. I think that was probably the most efficient use of the band. But my first prize would be that it all goes primarily to license exempt Wi-Fi. I think that's the better approach. And that takes into account that certainly with government deployments and fiber deployments, Wi-Fi is a critical component of those deployments. Wi-Fi 6 and Wi-Fi 7 are bringing us additional functionality, additional bandwidth, which makes a real difference. Those are excellent. It's excellent equipment and what can be done. And there's probably some convergence with 6G, 7G down the line coming along there.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, and I need to ask you about this because it's been in the news for weeks now, and that's the subject of Rika. Most recently, Shamil Jasub, the CEO of Vodacom Group, I made some comments saying that there's an urgent need to overhaul the Rika system in South Africa, that it's in effect broken. What's your take on the state of Rika and SIM card registration, and what in your view needs to be done to fix it?
So 100% it is broken. It has been broken for some time. It's 2002 legislation. I think it was amended in around 2010 when we had that big push for SIM card registration. But it is a system which has been gamed. Pre-registration of SIM cards, pre-recaying of SIM cards, batch purchases. That's in the SIM side, even on the ISP side, on the fixed side, where you're also required to reca. There's huge pushback against it because there's no enforcement. So you are ISPA, you require your subscriber to provide you with a copy of their ID and their utilities account. That's an obstacle to sign up. Provider B says, I'm not going to do that. So you lose customers to provider B, and there are no consequences for provider B, which disincentivizes you from complying. So RECA is actually a competitive issue on the fixed side. What's being done about it? It's been under review for about 4.5 years now. So there are two RECA processes. One is from the Amabungani judgment, where the Constitutional Court said you must do certain things. That's still outstanding, some 3.5, 4 years later. It's well out of time. And then there's this broader review of RECA, where certainly from my engagements with the Department of Justice, they've said they want to modernize it. They want online e-RECA links to Department of Home Affairs, population registers, all that kind of thing, which industry would welcome. But that process seems very stuck. So there was a parliamentary question a few weeks ago where details were given on all the engagements and stakeholder consultation that the DOJCD is doing. But ultimately, after a couple of years of doing that, we are no closer to having an amendment bill to update RECA in its entirety, and particularly the customer registration stuff. So I'm worried about what's happening at the DOJCD. There seem to be some functional challenges there, departmental problems. And where you get that in action, others start to step in. So ICASA says, well, we also can play a role with RECA because we're the custodian of the National Numbering Plan. So we want to introduce biometrics to be associated with numbers. The Association of Communication Technologies says, well, in the absence of an effective RECA customer registration system, we've come up with our own system, which our members can adopt on a voluntary basis to try and shore up this existing RECA system. So it's literally got so bad that industry is stepping in and saying, well, we're proposing that on a voluntary basis, we do this because we cannot wait for you to fix it. It is causing too much damage to us in terms of fraud and crime. So RECA is a very real issue. There's part of me as well, which is we've overdone it. I think there was a recent article relating to FICA and the similar customer registration processes under the Financial Intelligence Centers Act, which shows just how cumbersome this regulation has become and how it is not actually achieving the desired purpose. And that needs to be the starting point with RECA customer registration. We did this in 2002 in the aftermath of 9/11 and a surge of security-related legislation around the world. Is it still relevant? Is it still the best way to be doing it? And while we're at it, how do we deal with low Earth orbit satellites and others when it comes to RECA and South Africa's cybersecurity? Yeah, it is a good question, but certainly, I would say for a Starlink, what they need to bear in mind is that the day after they get awarded licenses, they fall within the definition of an electronic communication service provider. And the obligations in terms of the Cybercrimes Act, RECA, and other things fall on electronic communication service providers. So we need to see how practical that is. But as the law stands, you know, that Starlink would be rejoicing in getting the license on day one and then looking at the extent of their compliance obligations under about 22 different pieces of legislation on day two and saying, well, how are we going to deal with that?
Right. Tying your number to your biometrics, is that something we should be worried about from a civil liberties privacy perspective, or is there no issue with it?
We should worry about it from a security perspective and an identity theft perspective. Duncan, honestly, I'm probably not the best person to ask. I won't go into certain buildings in the parliamentary precinct because they require a thumbprint. And okay. I'm I'm wary of giving my biometrics to government because it's not going to be stored properly. So subject to proper security safeguards being built in, I think it is the way we need to go. And the mobile networks are very supportive of that. They see in their experience and certainly in what they're proposing around Rika is very much linked to biometrics.
Biometrics, yeah. Dominic Cull, always good to chat with you. Dominic is Regulatory Advisor for the Internet Service Providers Association, amongst other roles. And I'm Duncan McLeod for Tech Central. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Duncan.